Hello and welcome to the Brentas Foundation podcast, where we throw light on some of the African continent's biggest and most pressing issues and leverage best practice, not just on what to do, but how to do it. I'm your host, Marie-Noah Ngoklo, and it's a pleasure to share in this moment with you. If you're new here, welcome. It's nice to have you here. If you're a regular, hey, how's it going? So this is the podcast where I share a lot of the super interesting conversations I have with really cool people. I'm a firm believer in sharing ideas that shape and challenge the world as we know it. My hope is that these conversations, where you get to be a fly on the wall, start further and deeper conversations wherever you are and lead to the exploring of actions and ideas that actually work and make a difference. So without further ado, let's get straight into it. Again, I'm Marie Noel and you're listening to the Brentas Foundation podcast. Okay, so today we're headed to Japan. After the post-war recovery, 1945 to 49, and the Korean War from 1950 to 53, I believe, the Japanese economy entered into a period of high growth. From the mid-1950s to about early 1970s, average real growth was approximately 10%. Japan was doing well. By 1970, Japan, which had been devastated by, fighting and bombed by the US, overtook West Germany in economic size and became the second largest economy in the capitalist world after the United States. Essentially, we can say that within a generation, Japan had rebuilt itself from the ground up, reaching high income status by 1977. So, in today's episode, the first of a two-part series because the conversation was that good, I'm joined by Professor Kenichi Ono. Professor Ono is at the National Graduate Institute for Policy Studies in Tokyo. Professor Ono has worked closely with the Japanese government in designing international cooperation strategy and has advised the Vietnamese government since 1995. He's done policy research in over 20 countries in Asia and Africa, focusing on industrialization, policy learning for catch-up, the development experiences of Japan for latecomers, and international comparison of industrial policy quality. He's written several books, including The History of Japanese Economic Development, which you hear more about in this episode, Learning to Industrialize, which was published in 2013, and Eastern and Western Ideas for African Growth, also published in 2013. Professor Ono received the Presidential Medal for Friendship from the Vietnamese government and the Japanese Foreign Minister Award for contributing to Japan-Vietnam economic relationships. He's a man that has done a lot, a man of many talents, and I'm excited to have him here today. So without further ado, let's get straight into the chat with Professor Kenichi Ono. Joined by Professor Kenichi Ono, professor at the National Graduate Institute for Policy Studies in Tokyo. As you may have heard in the introduction before, he's an exceptional academic and practitioner, and that's one of the main reasons for having him here today. So in 2017, he published a book called The History of Economic Development, The Origins of Private Dynamism and Policy Competence. And today he's joining me to expound on some of the ideas in this book, especially Japan's high growth era, amongst other things. Professor Ono, it's a pleasure to have you here. Welcome to the Brentas Foundation podcast.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here.
Yes. Okay. So to get us started, I know I have to keep to time, so I won't try to fluff around too much. But can you start maybe by sharing a bit of an overview of Japan's journey from devastation to higher growth?
Okay, thank you very much. So today's focus is Japan's recovery from the war, and then the very high growth that happened in the mainly 1950s and 1960s. But we must go back a little bit in history to explain the beginning of this thing. Well, Japan began industrialization in the middle of the 19th century by absorbing Western systems and technology. And Japan was very successful economically and militarily. And by the 1920s, Japan joined what they call the Big Five. It's like a G7, the most advanced country group. At that time, US, UK, France, Italy, and Japan. However, in the 1930s, Japan began invading China and Southeast Asia militarily. In 1941, we went to war with much of the Western world, including the United States and UK. And then Japan was defeated in 1945 and was occupied by the US military force from 1945 to 1952. Okay, so that's the background. When this war ended, Japan was completely devastated. More than 3 million soldiers and civilians were killed out of the population of 70 million. And roughly half of the capital stock, such as machines, buildings, and infrastructure, was lost, destroyed by America's repeated incendiary bombing and, of course, the two atomic bombs. Now, most Japanese cities at that time were burned out. It was ashes and rubbles. Urban people were left without housing or food. The U.S. provided food and medical aid to avoid a large-scale starvation. So that's the situation after the war. And the recovery period was from 1945 to 49, about 5 years. There were three economic problems that the government had to tackle. One, very high inflation. It was a triple-digit inflation. Number two, industrial output was down to only 30% of the pre-war level, mainly due to the lack of energy and inputs. And number three, unemployment. But this was mostly absorbed in agriculture and urban informal sectors. Now, what did the Japanese government do at this time? Japanese policy sequence was as follows. Number one, we need an output recovery. It must be secured by any means. And then I think that the targeted sectors were steel and coal. And then when these steel and coal productions recovered, other industries started to recover. Number two is stopping inflation. And number three is liberalize the economy and restore the market mechanism. You see, output first, then inflation and liberalization. This sequence is quite different from what the typically IMF and the World Bank recommend. They said to stop inflation, liberalize, structure adjustment, and then output will recover under the free economy. We did not follow that sequence. Output recovery started in 1948. 2 or 3 years after the war, industries output began to pick up. Inflation was stopped 1 year later in 1949 by the usual austerity approach, which means severe fiscal and monetary tightening. And from 1950 to 53, Japanese production was artificially stimulated by Korean War demand. There was a war in Korean Peninsula. And then China and the Americans were fighting. This is a first fight between socialism and capitalism. American military procured enormous amount of military and non-military goods from Japan. So Japanese economy boomed. So by this time, this is the middle of the 1950s, the recovery from the war was more or less complete by this time. So after this, from 1955 to 1970, about 15 years, Japan entered what we call the high growth era. Japan grew and industrialized very fast, about 10% per year. Productivity and wage also rose about 10% per year, which means wage increased for workers without the loss of competitiveness for the industry because everything was rising at 10%. Electronics, mechanical, and material industries expanded and became globally competitive. and machinery exports grew to the extent that they caused the trade frictions with the United States. Now, Japan rejoined the advanced nation group by around 1970 in terms of income level, technology, and export competitiveness. So all in all, it took about 25 years from the complete devastation to the regaining of the top, the first class nation status. I think this is a relatively fast and compressed growth.
I'll let you finish that and then I'll come in here, sorry.
Well, the only thing I like to say is in this process, Japan never stopped at middle income. We never heard of the middle income trap at that time. We actually accelerated at the middle income and we slowed down only after attaining high income. And this is true not only for Japan, but with Korea, Taiwan, and Singapore. So that's the brief explanation of how high growth happened.
Yeah, no, that's perfect, actually. And there's one thing I wanted to follow up on, and which I think it's very interesting, is this idea that, So Japan actually didn't follow the recommendations from some of these global IFIs. I'm curious to know, what was that experience like that? Because Japan at this point was recovering. And the resources of some of these organizations or institutions must have been useful or helpful. So how did they manage those types of conversations and really the choice to say, we are actually going to do what we think is best? Because I think quite a number of countries, especially on the African continent, have struggled and still struggle with that. Not to say that they should not listen, but I'm curious to hear about Japan's experience.
Well, I think not only this time, but when Japanese economy is in crisis, we always think about the real sector recovery. We're interested in, you know, infrastructure, roads, ports, capacities of these infrastructure, then textile industry, electronics industry, which industries we will recover first. This is what we call the real sector approach or Gemba approach. Gemba is the place where production actually takes place, such as factories, farms, and construction sites. We did not follow the IMF World Bank prescription, and not only this time, but before and after this experience too. That's our approach for a long time. Not only this time, and one century ago, we started with the real sector, and the inflation stopping came later. Liberalization came even later. So that's the normal sequence for Japan. I think it's just historically more comfortable for Japanese. I don't think we want to liberalize and jump into the globalism unless we have already fostered some industries which are globally competitive enough. We don't want to jump in with all the weak industries. That's, I think, part of the Japanese standard mindset about industrialization.
Yeah.
We recommend this to all countries which Japan has an economic cooperation with, including African countries. Don't jump in unless you're prepared to jump in. Don't privatize and liberalize unless you can control the process. I think that's historically Japanese approach.
I would be curious to hear much later on how that advice has gone well. One question I wanted to ask is, how would you say that Japan found the right politics, right, to influence the economic outcomes? Because one of the things we are seeing sometimes, at least on this side of the world for quite a number of countries, is that it's not just the economics, it's the politics that influence that. So how did you manage to get the right politics that allowed it better economic outcomes?
We're talking about 1950s and 60s. The fact is, until the year 1960, and that's exactly 1960, Japan did not have the right politics for development. You see that the high growth year is around 1955 to 70. In the initial several years, we didn't have the politics. Until that time, there were serious divisions and political fights among citizens and political parties. The division was about choosing between, reformists and conservatists. That's very usual. And then at that time, we capitalism versus socialism. Some people wanted to promote big businesses and stay with the U.S. camp. The other people liked the USSR, the Russians, which were socialist state at that time. And these people wanted the benefits for workers and farmers. And that was a very serious political fight. There were strikes, there were demonstrations, there was a split in the political party, and sometimes this turned violent. That was up to 1960. But in 1960, two major confrontation events occurred, and the capitalist camp won over the socialist group. The first event was the renewal of the Japan-US Security Treaty. And then by renewing this treaty, Japan was firmly on the U.S. side, no more Soviet Union, and we will stay under the U.S. Nuclear umbrella, and we will not go into the socialist way. And the other event was the Mike coal mine strike. This was a confrontation between management and the workers, and the workers lost. So after 1960, Japanese economy and society, they were not politicized. We agreed on going on the capitalist way. And then the age of politics was over and Japan entered the age of economic growth. And the Prime Minister Ikeda said that we will double the income within 10 years. This is 10-year doubling income plan. This goal was actually attained in 7 years, 3 years ahead of schedule. The growth momentum after that was very strong. So the politics moved after 1960 in a very favorable way. It just turned out that way. There was no particular politician trying to move the politics dominated society to economic dominated society. It just happened. Another thing I'd like to say during this period is who created the growth, this strong double-digit growth. I think the private dynamism was very strong. That was the primary reason. So the businesses and the workers and the engineers, they were very willing to do it. But on the government side, economic technocrats were very effective in supporting the private sector. This is a very typical growth pattern in Japan during this post-war period. And also one century ago, the Meiji industrialization was just like this. The private dynamism went ahead and government supported it mostly effectively. At this time, during the high growth period, the prime minister set the broad goal for the nation, but economic technocrats worked on the details. The most important technocrats were those at the Ministry of International Trade and Industry, what we call MITI. Mm-hmm. These technocrats always talked to the businesses, drafted a plan, passed the necessary law in the parliament, implemented the plan, monitored it, and went to the next plan. In other words, they just work on the whole value chain or the process of the planning and implementation. They were the designer and implementer. And then prime ministers just endorsed the activities. The mindset and capacity of the Japanese technocrats were very high, despite their low salary. You see, the Japanese officials don't receive high salaries, but they still do it. In other words, Japanese industrial policies at that time were created bottom up. Japanese prime ministers were not very strong or charismatic. We had the Prime Minister Kishi, Prime Minister Ikeda, and Prime Minister Sato. Maybe they are not very famous because these were optional. These are replaceable prime ministers as long as MITI technocrats were doing the work. They were not like Lee Kuan Yew of Singapore or Park Chung-hee in Korea. These were the very powerful presidents and prime ministers, but Japan didn't have the strong prime ministers. Technocrats could do it with any prime minister. So that's basically
Professor Ono, I'm curious, and I think I'm pressing this a little bit, but why was that the case? Was there an incentive driving? Was it just the culture of the way things are done? Was it what the repercussions would be if they didn't do? Why was that the norm? Can you speak a little bit about that as well?
I think the competent technocrats was also the Japanese tradition, at least going back one century and probably more. Of course, there are a lot of corrupt officials in any age in the Japanese history, but when the government set a very clear national goal and then hired officials and gave them power or authority to implement the plan, not top down, but let them do the thing and then be proud and happy about it, then I think Japanese technocrats are very effective, not all the time, but during this post-war recovery time, and also one century ago, Meiji industrialization time, the technocrats were very, very dedicated and professional. I think I can say this, it comes from the Japanese history. But when the conditions are right, these technocrats work wonders. I think this is similar in Taiwan and Korea, that, and also Singapore, if the governments let them do the right thing instead of suppressing them and ordering them around, I think these technocrats do wonders. I think that's one of the features of the Asian governments, at least the high-performing Asian governments, that we are fortunate enough to have the potentially very good technocrats. And when the government set up the right framework, they do the right thing.
That brings us to the end of today's show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did putting it together. I love learning new things. Hey, if you enjoyed this chat, you definitely enjoy others that came before it. Check out previous episodes on whichever platform you're tuned into now, or visit our website, www.thebrentisfoundation.org, for other episodes. As always, thank you so much for listening. And if I could make one last ask of you, please do share this with others. Again, you're listening to Marie Noel on the Brentis Foundation podcast, and it's been a pleasure sharing this time with you. Until next week, stay well.